This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The economy is improving. Nationally, home starts, prices, and sales are up. In Charlotte, home sales and prices rose in August from a year ago, with prices up an average 11%. Car sales are brisk, and unemployment seems to be decreasing. Further, the North Carolina Economic Forecast predicts that 2014 will be a breakout year for the economy of the state. Yet the stock market has been on a roller coaster, and just this week, Bank of America was removed from the New York Stock Exchange's group of 30 stocks that make up the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Indeed, with every bit of good economic news, the market seems to react negatively. So what's an investor to do? This hour, we take our quarterly look at the economy with UNC Charlotte's Dr. John Connaughton, the keeper of the Babson Capital North Carolina Economic Forecast, a man predicting brighter days ahead in the Tar Heel State. And we're also going to get some advice on investing in this topsy-turvy climate from Kate Warren, an investment strategist with Edward Jones. She's been with their research department since 1997, is now a principal of the firm and a member of their Investment Policy Advisory Committee. Welcome back, John, and welcome to you, Kate Warren. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Connaught, let me begin with you, because you are breaking this breakout year next year. I've never seen that term in any of your economic forecasts, certainly not since you've been joining us quarterly during the recession and slightly after it. But that's a great term. It sounds like very good news, is it?
It is good news. I mean, I think that 2014 is, for the first time, people are going to look back, or during the year, they're going to think, oh, this does feel like a recovery. And, you know, this is kind of, we're approaching the fifth anniversary of the shoe falling, if you will, in 2008 when Lehman failed on September 15th. And so we're getting real close to that. And even though the recession began a few months earlier, December of 2007, for most people, their memory is that morning when Lehman failed and all the financial collapse that came afterwards. And despite the fact that technically we said, yeah, but a year and a half later, the recovery began in earnest in June of 2009, most people don't believe that. They haven't felt it. It hasn't felt that way for most companies or individuals. 2014 is actually going to start to feel like that, because we're looking at plus 3% growth, and that's really the first time that we'll have that level of output growth since this all began.
Are we still playing catch-up in North Carolina?
Oh, yeah. We're still playing catch-up nationally and in North Carolina. Our best estimate right now is that nationally we lost 8.7 million jobs. Roughly, at the current pace, roughly a year from now, sometime late next summer in 2014, we'll get back those 8.7 million jobs that we lost. And North Carolina's going to take a little bit further. We're projecting that we'll get those jobs back probably at the end of 2014, and we'll be net-net, if you will, right, with the job number in December of 2007.
Was it 5 years ago you said that Lehman fell?
Five years ago.
5 years ago was a scary, scary time, particularly for investors. And by investors, I mean everybody, including those of us who just have money in a 401k and hope to God that it's still there when we retire. And for many people who are on the cusp of retirement, that was a tragic time for them. Have things settled down enough to have, has confidence returned to the little guy, I guess is the good way to put it, investment world?
I think in many cases confidence hasn't returned, but investors over the last 5 years have had to say, where am I going to get the returns that will help me retire? And in most cases, that's the stock market. Mm-hmm. Now, many people have been putting money into bonds because the yields have been good, but as interest rates have started to rise over the last few months, they're suddenly realizing, no, I probably need to be a little more in stocks than I was before, because when interest rates rise, bond prices fall. So do I think confidence has returned? Somewhat, but not as much as it needs to.
Has the money returned? Because before the recession, I remember going to parties. That's the only topic of conversation. The great stock that I found, and here's what it's doing, and I bought it last week for 20. It's now at 70. You got to buy it today. No, it's too late to buy. It's going down. But I'm already out of it. That was the whole conversation. Are people doing that anymore?
Well, the good news is they're not. And the reason that's good news that they're not is that that's not a good way to invest. What you need to have is a much more systematic plan. You need to figure out what your goals are, and especially if you're near retirement, basically where you need to go. And if you're getting your tips from neighbors at, you know, because they bought a hot stock, you're probably making a lot of mistakes. You're probably buying high, just like your example suggested. And then, of course, when it plunges, you're going to sell.
Right.
So the much better thing to do is figure out what you need to do to get to your retirement or whatever your other financial goal is. And that's usually a mix of stocks and bonds. But the key is to be really well diversified and not to chase hot tips. I would say in terms of what people are doing, yes, what we've seen is people are gradually becoming comfortable enough to go back to their plan if they got away from it. And the sooner that people do that, the better off they're going to be. Because if you're just listening to the news, one of the things that's really interesting is everybody talks about how poor the economy's been, but people aren't hearing how good the stock market's been. Up basically more than 150% from the lows. It's above the average recovery from past recessions. And while, as John just said, you know, people are saying no recovery, the stock market actually is recovering and is doing quite well.
Does that impact the economy, the recovery of the stock market?
Well, you know, I think that is interesting. I mean, what we had was this roller coaster with the market during this period of time where very shortly after Lehman failed, the market lost more than half its value. The Dow got down to 6,000 and change, and now it's up at 15,000. And as I say to people, you know, if you just closed your eyes and went to sleep on September 15th, 2008, and didn't look at your 401k, you got more money in that now, even if you didn't contribute any more, than what you had in 2008.
But you lost time.
You lost time. Well, I'm not sure you lost a lot of time because the market's higher now than it was when the crash started.
Had it not crashed, wouldn't we be at 20,000 or 25,000?
Yeah, the market, the Dow or the S&P 500 is tracking what the prices of stocks are, not your return. If you own stocks that paid no dividends, then yeah, you're right. But most stocks pay some dividend, and you should. I'm getting into your expertise here, but I would think that your portfolio should contain some stocks that pay some dividends.
And actually, in addition, your portfolio should have some bonds. And so for most people who have some mix of stocks and bonds, if they just stayed invested, if they'd done what John suggested and been asleep and not paid any attention, a mix of almost any stocks and bonds was back above where it was at the peak in 2007 by the end of 2010. Now, of course, the people who got out and were watching the market and said, oh, my gosh, I just can't stomach this, their portfolios, unless they got back in, are still down. But the key is if you stay invested, even through this terrible time where the stock market dropped 50%, what you are now is considerably above where you were. And no, you haven't lost any time. The thing you would have lost is if you got out and didn't get back in.
Okay.
And I think there's a lesson in all of that. And that is that, you know, trying to time the market is for average people is a disaster. But more importantly, if you buy and hold and you just ride this thing out, the resiliency of the U.S. economy is likely to pay off for you.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but one of our listeners is interested in this, so I'm going to bring his question to the table here. Robert on our website says, why do your guests think Lehman Brothers was allowed to go bankrupt in 2008? Was it because President Bush had a grudge with Lehman? Did the White House know that what would happen to the world economy if they let Lehman go down?
I think they thought that they needed to send a lesson to basically the markets that you can't just take lots of risk and you always get bailed out.
Did they do that because they thought that was the only institution going down? Or had they known that there would be others to follow, would they have done that?
I think two things. They didn't think it would be as bad as it turned out to be. Mm-hmm. So I would guess that they underestimated the risks that they were going to trigger by letting Lehman and then AIG fail. And it's as much AIG as Lehman that actually led to most of the financial downturn. But the second thing is they were under a lot of political pressure basically not to continue to bail out the banks, and we still hear that today.
Right.
Dodd-Frank and everything else is, let's make sure we never bail out the banks again. People don't understand that in many cases, if you don't bail out the banks, then you actually are unraveling the financial system behind all of the things that we actually take for granted
right.
every day.
And all those banks, except for just a tiny few, have paid back the money with interest, right?
Absolutely.
Just to correct just a little part of it, the White House really wasn't involved in this in any way, shape, or form. This was done by the Fed mostly, although the Treasury Secretary Paulson was involved in the talks. The White House, the Treasury, doesn't have any tools to deal with that at all. So it's the FDIC, although they weren't involved with Lehman because they only were involved at the time with commercial banks, but mostly the Fed. And the second thing is that the Fed had essentially – Bear was in the process of failing several months early in the spring of 2008. The Fed did save – Bear Stearns caught so much political flack for it. I think they were a little gun shy, and yeah, we probably, in hindsight, you know, looking back on it, shouldn't have let Lehman fail. But, you know, it's just terrible the way people think that somehow or other, when we did introduce TARP, that was a really negative thing and, you know, all the banks always win. If more banks had failed, okay, the financial system in this country would have ceased to operate and we all would have lost our jobs simply because companies – couldn't even write checks.
Yeah, they would have no access to cash.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the economic forecast, because we spend a lot of time when you visit us, not just looking forward, but looking back. And I want to look back on the predictions you made about this time last year, about this year. Have things unfolded the way you thought they would? Have there been surprises? Have there been disappointments?
I think that when we looked, say we look back a year ago and we were saying what was going to happen, we were aware that there was going to be a showdown the first of the year. In Congress, and they're going to be a showdown over two issues. And one was the Bush tax cuts going forward and what form that was going to take. And the second was what kind of spending cuts we're going to get and, were we really going to stare down the barrel of the gun and let sequestration take effect. And so we had so much uncertainty going in. The one thing that we did know is the first half of 2013 probably wasn't going to be very good, simply because the history – remembering what happened in 2011, summer of 2011, with the debt ceiling, and we went right up to the 12th hour before we did anything on that. The history told us that this was going to go down to the wire before somebody blinked. So that consumers get extremely nervous because they don't understand what it is Congress is doing, and all they see are two trains going down a track at 60 miles an hour, and they're only an inch apart at this point in time, and so they get nervous, and when they get nervous, they stop doing things, and which means they stop consuming.
And that happened.
And so we dug ourselves a hole for the first part of the year on two levels. One, consumer confidence dropped during that period of time, and so consumers dropped out of the market. And they're 70% of GDP, so without consumers, things really slow down. The second thing that happened, in addition to consumer confidence, was we did have a tax increase. Everybody's taxes went up, not just the rich, not just the 1%. Everybody's taxes went up on January 1st. It took money out of consumers' pockets. And so you've got confidence kind of taking a hit, and at the same time, the wallet's leaner.
And this year, capital gains taxes went up. So how has that impacted, and how should that impact your decisions to invest?
Actually, it shouldn't make much difference because overall they went up a small amount. But what you're looking for is the return. Never let the tax tail, wag your investment dog, because what you're looking for.
If you're paying capital gains taxes,
that's a good thing.
It means you've made a profit.
You made money.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're a little higher is not something that you should be saying, oh my gosh, I want to avoid taxes to the extent.
Why do we hear all the people who have so much money invested in the stock market complaining about capital gains taxes going up? Because if they're paying taxes, they're making money.
Yes.
Why do we hear that?
And the answer is, of course, nobody likes to pay more in taxes.
Yeah.
So, again, don't let what people say change how you're investing. What you want over time is capital gains, because they're still taxed at a lot less than ordinary income.
Yeah.
And, of course, if you own a bond, what you're getting is interest payments that are taxed at your ordinary income rates. So the one thing that people didn't want was to find capital gains and dividends taxed at the same higher rates at your ordinary income rates, because that's money that you've already paid taxes on that you've then invested. And what you do want in the U.S. is incentives for people to continue to invest. And that's really important, and that's why you always hear that argument.
Jobs, jobs, jobs.
We
have to take a break.
Oh,
you can't do that now. You can come back. We'll come back and let you follow up on that, John Connaughton. And then I want to talk about jobs, jobs, jobs. Dr. John Connaughton here from UNC Charlotte, and Kate Warren from Edward Jones are coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Lenore Ryan University graduate programs offering master's degrees in a variety of disciplines from the Hickory, Asheville, and Columbia, South Carolina campuses. Details at lr.edu/graduate. And Mr. Rogers Windows, a local family business since 1986, offering renewal by Anderson replacement windows and entry door systems installed by trained craftsmen. Product details at mrrogerswindows.com. Well, are you superstitious? Tomorrow, is Friday the 13th. Do you dread that day? Are you staying home? Are you staying in bed? Do you avoid walking under ladders? Feel funny about black cats crossing your path? Ever cross your fingers? Well, even if you're not superstitious, do you ever wonder how those superstitions came to be? We're going to find out Friday the 13th, knock on wood, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Reams Show, the use of prescription painkillers has boomed over the past decade. New research shows that narcotics are often ineffective for long-term pain and can have serious health consequences.
Listen to that conversation after Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on the Diane Reams Show. Here on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. John Connaughton, the director of the Babson Capital UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast for the state of North Carolina, and Kate Warren, an investment strategist and a principal at Edward Jones. We're talking about the economic forecast and also about how to invest in this economy. And you wanted to follow up on the capital gains.
Right. Situation. For most people, most of their investment is in 401ks, and that has nothing to do with capital gains. Those are tax-deferred accounts. You can get capital gains going on while you own that 401k. It's only when you withdraw money, and every dollar, whether you earn money on it or not, mm-hmm. when it comes out of a 401k, it taxes your ordinary income tax rate at that time. So for most people, don't even think about cap gains as an issue as to whether or not you should invest or you shouldn't invest.
Okay.
What the 401k does for you is it allows you to put more money in because, if you had $100 to put in or you had $100 and you want to invest it, the first thing, if you did it in a taxable account, you'd have to pay taxes that year you earned it. So you'd only have $70 to put into it. But with a tax-deferred account, you actually get to put the whole 100 in, so you've got a bigger principal on which to build.
Moody's Analytics reported last week that the private sector nationally added 176,000 jobs in August, 198,000 in July. You're forecasting a gain in North Carolina of 86,000 jobs next year, a jump over the 53,000 jobs that you still believe we will add this year. When you compare those yearly figures to the 176,000 national figure in August, how do they stack up?
Well, we're doing during the last 3.5 years since the recovery began, we haven't done quite as well in terms of generating the jobs that we've done nationally. And, of course, nationally, the lack of job growth has been a story and has been an issue. So nationally, about 76% of the jobs have been gotten back so far that were lost. We're in the mid-60 range in terms of the percentage of the jobs that we've gotten back. So mm-hmm. we're doing a little bit less well. In addition, North Carolina's unemployment rate is now the third worst in the nation at 8.9%. Only a couple of states have worse unemployment rates than North Carolina does. Not very good. We've not done as well. But there are two issues. One is just the job growth and how many of the jobs that we lost have we added back. But there's also another issue that's probably bigger than that, and that is the mismatch between the jobs that we lost and the skills required in those jobs and the jobs that are growing and the skills required in those jobs. So of the 334,000 jobs we lost locally, mm-hmm. Two-thirds of those, or close to two-thirds, a little over, almost 200,000 of them, were in manufacturing and construction. Blue-collar jobs, typically high school education, maybe a little college, but that's typically what we're looking at. Those were jobs that paid decent wages and provided a middle-class income for those families. We really haven't added very many of those jobs back, just a few thousand manufacturing jobs. What we're adding jobs, where all these new jobs are coming that we've added in the last 3.5 years, are in predominantly business and professional services, health and educational services. Those skills in those areas require not just a college degree, but in many instances an advanced college degree. So the job skills gap isn't like it was in previous recessions/recoveries, where you maybe had a 1 or 2 year educational gap that you could easily fill with community colleges. We're talking about high school education to master's degrees and above. That's a big gap that doesn't get filled easily.
And despite the slowness of the job recovery in North Carolina, housing starts are up, prices are up, home sales are up. What's driving that?
Well, there are two things that are driving that. Number one, we've worked our way through a lot of foreclosures over the past 5 years. We basically got rid of that overbuilt stock, that stock of houses that had loans that were not sustainable for a variety of reasons, mm-hmm. whether they were non-qualifying, subprime, ninja loans, no income, no asset, no job, or what have you. Those have been foreclosed. We've worked our way through. The market has shed most of those homes. And so now when we're going forward, anyone who's looking at buying a new home or buying a home, the market looks a lot more like it did back in 2003 and 2004. And builders are having to bring homes online. There's no longer this excess supply of these foreclosed homes.
But I guess the question I'm asking, if nobody has a job, how are they buying a house?
Well, no. Mike, let's back away from that just a little bit. You know, and I think the stock market reflects a little of this. The market's doing well because 90% of the economy is doing well.
Okay.
Company profits are up. Those that are employed are doing fine. Interesting enough, when we talked about those folks in business and professional services and health and educational services, because there's actually a shortage of skilled workers in those areas, those wages are being bid up. So, you know, there's a sort of a tale of two economies here.
Okay.
Those folks that were hammered by this recession, and those industries that were hammered by it, and then, you know, the rest of the 90% of the economy.
As John just said, Kate Warren, there's good news everywhere that a lot of sectors are doing well. Unemployment is going down. Consumer confidence is rising. The stock market has just had three triple-digit days, and yesterday's triple-digit day was attributed, I think, to the lessening of tensions over Syria and the United States. But every time we seem to get some good economic news, the market seems to react negatively because the Fed then says, well, you know, things look pretty good. We're going to pull back on some of these things that we've been doing to help the economy along. And the stock market goes crazy. Is that irrational?
No, it's not irrational because the stock market's concerned that if the Fed starts to slow down the amount of bonds it buys every month, mm-hmm. it buys $85 billion in bonds every month, and that's to continue to keep interest rates low, which is part of the reason, as John just talked about, that everybody's been buying houses because mortgage rates have been extraordinarily low. We've seen record low mortgage rates. And the worry is that as the economy strengthens, which is generally good news, the Fed begins to pull back on the support it's providing, and that creates sort of a different environment. So the stock market's saying, we don't like this uncertainty, we don't know what the Fed's going to do, and we don't like the fact that we're going to have less support from the Fed going forward. But keep in mind, those are short-term reactions. That's not something that says the environment's getting worse. It's just a reaction to you begin to change what's going on, and markets tend to sell first and ask questions later.
But these are essentially what the Fed is doing here are price supports. Essentially,
No, they're not price supports.
It's not incentives. It's not incentives for rich people to invest.
No. Think about the fact that most people who buy homes are not rich. So, if you've gotten a lower mortgage rate over the last couple of years because interest rates are low, that's been something that's been good.
Subsidies. They're subsidies.
No. They're not subsidies. What the Fed's been doing is trying to keep rates low. The Fed controls short-term rates, but the market sets long-term rates. And that's the thing to keep in mind. The market sets rates, not the Fed.
But the Fed has been intervening in the long-term rates. Part of this purchase is $40 billion a month in long-term mortgages and car loans and things like that, which is typically not what the Fed does. Fed typically has a lot of activity in short-term treasuries. They have been through this whole cycle. I've been buying longer term. Now, they're doing it for two reasons. One is a stimulative reason, so there's a little bit of subsidy, if you will, in that. But the second is there's a realization that the financial sector took a big hit. And banks aren't working the same, even today, to this point in time, still aren't doing the same kinds of things that they did before. We don't necessarily want that to happen.
They
don't do the kinds of things that you would expect banks to do. Okay. And so they're not as heavily into a number of different lines of loans that they used to be into. And so the Fed is trying to, in a sense, underwrite that, take some of the pressure off of banks as they rebuild their capitals. Positions in order for those markets to work a little bit better.
Heather emails a question along these same lines, the fact that every time we get some good economic news, the market reacts negatively because of the fear that the Fed will stop, in her words, flooding the economy with money. How will the Fed overcome this fear of in the long run, or will it have to? Will the market just take its course?
Well, I'd say the market would take its course, but there's a second point to be made, and that's that the Fed has been buying these loans, buying treasuries, buying mortgage-backed securities with the idea of keeping interest rates low. So it buys them from banks. That means the cash that Heather's talking about is sitting on the balance sheet of the banks, not out in the economy. And the Fed's bought the bonds, the banks have the cash. But anybody who's tried to get a loan recently knows that the banks aren't exactly delighted to make loans. They're still very tight on credit requirements. They're essentially not putting that in the economy. And I think a lot of people have said, oh, quantitative easing, this is money floating around, that leads to inflation, it leads to other things. And the thing that we're seeing right now, as John was just saying, is the banks are not functioning like they were in the past. They're not functioning really as conduits of that money into the economy. They're sitting on it, building up their capital, due to the new capital requirements, and that's made the banks much, much healthier. But it's not money that's out in the economy, and the Fed's sort of trying to substitute for the fact that there's money not really out in the economy right now.
Plus, there's another wild card out there. I don't want to throw this out and get everybody nervous, but
the debt ceiling?
Well, no.
We'll talk about that in a minute.
It's kind of like this triple witching coming at the end of September. We've got the budget. Okay, the fiscal year ends September 30th. All right, so in 18 days, Congress allegedly is supposed to have a budget ready to run fiscal year 2014. I don't know how likely that is, but at the same time, we're also starting to run up against our debt ceiling, and Congress has to authorize an increase in that. It doesn't necessarily correspond with September 30th, but it's in the fall sometime. But there's one more thing coming up that's going to throw a wrench into all this, and that is that sometime this month, President Obama is going to announce his nomination for the new Fed chair. Bernanke is not going to serve past January unless Congress can't, the Senate can't confirm. And so there's going to be a new Fed chair announced this month probably by the president. And when that happens, there's going to be all kinds of speculation depending on whom he nominates as to what the Fed's going to be doing in the future. There are two prime candidates, but it's still not clear.
So let me get back to this breakout year that you're predicting for 2014. What will that mean to the average person? If you're right about this, does it mean more jobs? Does it lower unemployment? Does it mean more money in the economy? Does it mean I'll be able to buy more stuff? What does it mean?
Well, I think there are two things that are going on right now, Mike, that's starting to generate a general understanding by people that the economy is getting better. You mentioned at the opening about housing prices, and I need to correct you just a little bit. Nationally, the year-to-year increase in housing prices has been a little over 12%, 12.1. And in Charlotte specifically, it's been 7.8% increase year-to-year in housing prices. Okay. This is the first time since this all began that we've actually seen prices start to rebound. This changes consumer perceptions. For the last 6 months, while this information has been kind of out there and we've been getting this buildup, if you will, I think that the average consumer really hasn't been as aware of this because it gets buried in a news story here, buried in a statement there. But as month after month after month after month of this starts to come through, pretty soon people are going to start to realize that, my goodness, housing prices are rising. And that changes consumer psychology. Click. It's like a switch. And we're getting into that period now.
And interest rates are rising. So are people being motivated to buy now?
That's right.
Because do it now because it's going to be more expensive if I don't do it.
And for the last 5 years, what we've had is a situation where interest rates have been going down and housing prices have been going down. And that's rational consumers are sitting there saying, why should I buy now? If I wait, I can get it cheaper. Mm-hmm. Well, now there's the reverse is happening. Jeez, if I wait, guess what's going to happen? It's going to cost me more.
During the recession, a lot of people, because of low interest rates, abandoned bonds and went to dividend-paying stocks because they needed the income or because that seemed to be the safest place to go. And now that the economy is recovering, I'm told that the wise investor will gravitate toward growth stocks. Is that what people should be doing right now?
Absolutely. They should be looking at growth stocks and especially stocks that are likely to grow their dividends over time. So don't forget about the dividend. But as the economy picks up and the national economy has been doing better than the North Carolina economy, but is likely to pick up as well, just not a breakout year, I would say, then what you're getting is more support for those stocks that have more growth component. And so investors absolutely should be looking at growth stocks as well as the more traditional dividend-paying stocks. But don't forget about the income. That's still an important part of buying stocks. But I would say investors should be doing that.
Tom in Charlotte wants to talk about older investors, investors near retirement, and whether it's wise to purchase life insurance as an investment. You're going to say no because you're a stockbroker.
Well, no. Edward Jones offers life, you know, all kinds of products as well as, you know, stocks and bonds and, you know, things like that. I would say life insurance as an investment doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. Certainly older, I mean, there's sort of an interesting mix in that question. Most people who want to buy life insurance are thinking of it as a way to replace income when they're working, not as something that they want to buy when they're older and in retirement. So I would want to know more about the questioner, because that's the kind of question you can't answer for everybody in general. You really need to understand somebody's specific
situation. But how is life insurance an investment in any case? If it is at all an investment, how is it an investment? Because it's tailored to pay off when you die.
Exactly. And so that's why it's frequently used as part of estate planning, which, of course, is part of your investment picture because of that, you know, characteristic. But no, it's a little puzzling to look at that as an investment unless it's tied in to some kind of overall package.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, that life insurance is for estates that are over the
exactly.
threshold.
And it's,
$3 million,
which
is
now,
is it
no,
now?
It's now $5 million. So it's above $5 million. It's 5.1 or 5.2. So again, coming back to that issue.
It's a tax tool.
It's not really part of your investment portfolio, and it's typically something where you're trying to replace income. You know, it's yes, when you die, but the reason you want life insurance while you're working is so your family can replace the income
right.
that obviously won't be there because you're no longer around.
Richard emails, doesn't the Fed policy, I don't know what policy he's talking about, penalize people who have been disciplined and saved? Do they get no interest income? Why doesn't Congress drive the economy with infrastructure investments so the Fed can let us earn a dollar on bonds?
Great question.
Yes, it absolutely is a great question. It certainly is a penalty on people who saved and invested.
Right. People who are risk averse and 5 years ago were getting 5% return on CDs, and now they're getting, if they're lucky, 1.25% on CDs, have taken a big hit as a result of the Federal Reserve policy. But I will simply
– All right, let's stop.
Please let me finish because the gentleman that wrote in made a comment of why isn't the government involved in stimulating the economy with fiscal policy, dealing with infrastructure improvements, which goodness knows most of our infrastructure, bridges, roads, et cetera, are
replaced.
Falling apart. Mm-hmm. And I will simply remind that particular listener that when Bernanke has to get up twice a year before Congress and they criticize him for his monetary policy, he will dress them down and explain he's the only one doing his job, you're not doing your job. And he will
and usually people
times.
Who ask that question also then are people who think sequestration was great and we should be balancing the federal budget,
That's
which
exactly
is
what
exactly
doing.
The opposite of what you know, he's talking about.
If you're the kind of investor who have invested conservatively, you are a conservative, and so you should want these infrastructure investments because it would raise your bond rates, it would raise your conservative. I have to stop. We can come back and give me an answer to that in a second. Kate Warren is with us from Edward Jones. Dr. John Condison from UNC Charlotte. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bilo Supermarkets, introducing Czech Soda with a variety of flavors, including orange pineapple, grape strawberry, and premium draft root beer. Available at Bilo. More information at buy-low.com. And Nexen Pruitt, 190 lawyers, helping companies meet business challenges in court and at the deal table from Charlotte and 7 other Carolina locations. Next challenge, next level, Nexen Pruitt. For the first time in a century, the top 10% of earners took in more than half of the country's total income. Guest host Tom Gelton fills in today for Diane Rehm on The Diane Rehm Show. He and his guests talk about how America's growing wealth inequality affects our society, politics, and the economy. That's in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is a great place to start, and we are coming right back.
The time has come. to select one.
The bright lights of showbiz have been shining around Charlotte.
Representing District 12 in the 74th annual Hunger Games.
WFAE's next public conversation will explore how the local film industry works and what it means for the region. We'll also discuss where it's going and whether state incentives for filmmakers are a good deal for taxpayers. Join us Thursday evening, September 19th at Discovery Place. RSVP at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Dr. John Connaughton from UNC Charlotte. He's the director of the Babson Capital UNC Charlotte North Carolina Economic Forecast, which comes out quarterly, and it's a good one for the 2014 with a breakout year predicted. We're talking about that and about how to invest in this economy, because every time good news seems to come out, the stock market takes a wild ride. Doctor, and she is a doctor. I neglected to mention that Kate Warren has a PhD. She's also an investment strategist with Edward Jones. And just prior to the break, we got a question from an emailer about monetary policy and fiscal policy and why the Congress doesn't do its job, essentially, and build infrastructure in these tight times so that people who are investing conservatively can get more return on their investment. The people who are pushing for frugality in government spending are the kinds of people, one would assume, that are investing conservatively because they are conservatives. But they're hurting themselves? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I would say everybody who invests conservatively isn't necessarily politically conservative.
Okay, all right.
Because we do have politically liberal people who invest conservatively. Those two don't quite align. So I would start with that point. But yes, people who've been disciplined, they've saved, they've invested over time, they're getting low returns on their fixed income. And that's partly because the Fed is trying to say, take more risk. So I would say that's a message they should listen to. But I think more important in that listener's question is the Federal Reserve, in keeping monetary policy extraordinarily loose, is trying to offset the fact that the government has very tight fiscal policy, and that we're focused on cutting government spending rather than trying to deal with the fact that the economy still needs some help and that they could do that on the fiscal side. Everybody's looking further down the road to the fact that we see growing entitlement spending, mm-hmm. and that there's deficits as far as the eye can
see. Right.
And what they're forgetting is short term, you may want to do different things than you want to do long term.
But where's that money coming from? And if you are spending money on infrastructure financed by the bonds that these people want higher return on investment for, in other words, you're taking out a loan and you got to pay more for the loan. Where's all this money coming from?
Well, I think there's a little bit of a misnomer in what's going on here. I think there are two problems. One is, once we hit the $1 trillion a year deficit number, mm-hmm. it was sort of a threshold that got passed, and all of a sudden, the truth of the matter is $1 trillion deficit's like a $500 billion deficit was 20 years ago, which we ran in those recessions.
Okay.
So it isn't exactly the same, but it's just symbolically created a threshold, if you will, in terms of clicking people's brains on and saying, oh, my goodness, this is now becoming a big problem.
This is real money now.
This is real money, and it's a big problem. And so what happened was that we had a stimulus package in 2008, it was about $160 billion. People got some money back under Bush. And then we had another one in 2009. It was $800 and something billion. And probably wasn't designed as well as it should have been. Mm-hmm. And the prospect, once we hit a $1 trillion deficit, to get another stimulus package, another fiscal policy package through, was pretty close to zero. And that's why the Fed's been doing what they're doing. But in practical terms, in terms of how the economy would react to another $500 million stimulus in 2011 or 2012, it actually would have been probably positive. By the way, I just want to make one quick point. People aren't paying attention to this. This fiscal year, 2013, started last October 1st, will end this September 30th. The budget deficit in the United States is projected to be somewhere in the mid-$600 billion range. It's come down well below. The 3% rule, if you will, for a budget deficit would put it somewhere in the 540 $3 billion range. So we're almost at the point of a 3% budget deficit, which is non-problematic under even the most conservative views of how a government should run. So the fact that we had some sequestration, the fact we had some tax increases, and the fact that the economy is getting better has narrowed that budget gap considerably.
We talked about the jobs recovery nationally, which is doing better than we are, and it's predicted to go forward more quickly than we are. But Lee emails, these new jobs, a huge number of them at least, are part-time, and many service industry jobs have been reduced to part-time, which is why we don't feel this recovery. And regarding stocks, what is going to happen to them when the inevitable inflation from the Fed stimulus corrects for all the money they've been virtually printing these past 4 years to prop up the economy?
Two things. I'd say if you actually look at the jobs nationally that have been created, and John may have more detail on this, certainly locally, most of the jobs are actually full-time jobs. The part-time job, yes, we've seen part-time jobs created. We have a lot of people who are working part-time who would like full-time jobs. And we also know that some of the jobs have been reduced below 30 hours. We hear a lot of anecdotes about that as people have tried to position, companies have tried to position themselves so they don't necessarily have to put in health care benefits. But when you look at overall job creation, it's been more full-time jobs than you would have expected in this. I would say to answer the second part of his question, people keep worrying about higher inflation. Inflation is actually running right around 2% right now. It's well below its historic average. And when we look forward, we see almost no signs of higher inflation. And the reason is, think about the fact that there's still large numbers of people who need jobs. That keeps downward pressure on wages, and we're a service economy. So if wages aren't rising across the board, it's really hard to see prices going up very much. There's another side. And the second part to this is we still have a lot of countries in the rest of the world that are industrializing, that are sending in cheaper goods. So there's downward pressure not only on the services we buy here, but on the goods we buy from abroad.
And anecdotally, just as a good measure of that, you'll notice and there was this incredible fear and run-up in gold prices, and now they're, you know, that right. bottom is falling and is likely to continue to falling. And so I would say that if you look –
because gold is a hedge on inflation.
Gold is a hedge.
Gold actually isn't a hedge on inflation.
It was considered to be a hedge on inflation. But if you look at the Fed's behavior and the amount of securities that the Fed has been buying, securitized debt, the Fed has been buying, but basically originated by banks, which they've chosen not to hold and sell to the Fed because they get a good deal on it. Mm-hmm. When you look at that money that Kate was talking about earlier that's been going into the economy, and you look at the excess reserve position of banks, it's over $2 trillion now. And you can look at the latest round of quantitative easing over the past 6 or 7 months, and every month you can watch that number go up. Just about by the same amount that the Fed has bought.
Right. And the reason the banks are holding these excess reserves that Sean's talking about, it's basically the Fed's printing the money, but it's sitting on bank balance sheets. It's sitting as excess reserves held at the Fed. And the reason is regulation of the financial services industry. The bank regulators are saying you have to hold more capital. That's a good thing. But the banks need that more capital, and the best thing to hold is cash. And they aren't making a lot of money on the loans. So why would you loan money out and take more risk in an environment where you need to hold more capital?
Very quickly, because this money is sitting in the banks on their balance sheets. It's actually sitting in the Fed, but it's on the banks' balance sheets. Because it's there, because there's $2 trillion there that banks have, when the Fed begins to sell these bonds back to the banks, because they're the ones that are going to buy them, and it's not going to happen overnight like that. They're just going to pull that money out of those excess reserves to buy those back. They're just going to make swaps, if you will, in the basement of the Federal Reserve. They'll throw a few bonds over on your account, and they'll pull a couple of dollars out of your account, and that money will disappear. I think Kate said it earlier, and I think this is really what's very, very important. That money never got into the economy. When it sits in the vault of the Federal Reserve as excess reserve, it's not in the economy. It never got there. So it's in a sense isolated. The Fed can pull it back very easily and make sure that it doesn't get in the economy if the economy starts to do the 3-3.5% growth next year that we expect it to.
On Morning Edition this morning, they had an interview with the author of a book. I think it was called Average is Over. Mm-hmm. He paints a pretty bleak picture. And despite your prediction of a breakout year in 2014 in North Carolina, this guy prints a very bleak picture about going forward. in the American economy, because he says essentially that the post-World War II economy of the rising middle class, where everybody did better the following year, and kids did better than their parents, and their kids did better than their grandparents, that's over. It's done. That we're going to find a lot of people doing very, very, very well, but there'll be no second chances. You'll do what you do, and if you do it well and you don't stumble, you can rise to the top very quickly and stay there. But if you stumble, it's over for you. And so there'll be a lot of people out there who are struggling to be middle class. They'll have middle class values, but they won't have middle class incomes. What does this all mean?
I haven't read the book, but I would disagree. And in particular, what we're seeing is, in the U.S., a higher and higher return from education. So if I think as we go forward, what we're going to see is continuing good jobs, but as John was talking about earlier, they're jobs that require more education. And what we're seeing is people not stay in school. If you don't stay in school, you're not likely to have the skills needed to get those better jobs. So I would say in terms of the future of the U.S., there are actually a lot of bright spots. We're in the middle of an energy revolution where basically across the country we're producing as much oil as we were back in the 90s. I used to be the energy analyst. And 10 years ago we were talking about how we were going to have to import natural gas and how we were going to have to keep importing more and more and more crude oil. That's all turned around in the last 10 years.
Is that because of fracking?
That's because of fracking. And in particular, fracking produces a lot more natural gas. So we're now talking about exporting natural gas. Huge turnaround, but that has big implications for the cost of energy across the country, which people may not have noticed, but their home heating bills have come down over time because we've had low natural gas and basically better costs in terms of the cost of energy. The second thing is, in many cases, we're seeing companies now put back in energy-intensive businesses in the U.S., which are, again, good jobs because the low cost of energy is here. And that's just one example where I think people have looked at the last few years and said, oh, my gosh, there's no future. There's actually a really bright future. But you have to understand that things change in response to the conditions, and you can't just look at what was going on the last couple of years and draw long-term conclusions.
I listened to that on the way in this morning, and I'm going to be a little skeptical on it on two fronts. One, it's very easy during a period of a downturn to make these and people – a lot of people are buying into that. It makes them feel like, well, yeah, it's not my fault, somebody else's fault, so they buy into it. And the real skeptic in me says, well, let's see. If I got to sell a book, if I'm very negative, I'm going to get a lot more buyers than if I'm very positive. So
you are a skeptic.
I'm a little bit of a skeptic, but I agree. I don't think this is on the horizon. I think there's some short-term dislocations that we talked about earlier in terms of all these folks that have manufacturing construction jobs. They lost those jobs. It looks like they're never coming back. Well, you know, they're not going to come back as quickly, and maybe the folks that lost those jobs aren't the ones that are going to fill those manufacturing construction jobs when they come forward. But if everything happens the way we expect it to, we're going to start adding construction jobs next year.
I want to get back to economic forecasting, which is what you do. There was a recent article in the New York Times about how information gathering to produce these economic forecasts, not just yours, but national forecast, and to take snapshots of where the economy is at any given moment is changing. That data collection from companies like Intuit, which makes QuickBooks, they actually look into individual small business QuickBooks accounts to see how their software is being used. That information is being used to help make economic forecasts. Google Analytics, throw that in. It's all providing more accurate, continuously updated information on the health of the economy. If you agree with that, I don't know that you do, what might that mean to our ability to react to good or to bad economic news, to shorten our reaction time, to perhaps ward off impending recessions?
Yeah, I mean, as I think it's a good point, and I think obviously the data age that we're in, the information age that we're in, is changing the way in which the timeliness that we're getting information. The problem is, going back to what we talked about a little earlier, you know, that's all fine and good, and if we know about it, but we have to act on it. And we have two tools. One is monetary policy, the other is fiscal policy. And right now, you know, with Congress the way it is, fiscal policy is a non-starter. And so even if you know, and you know more timely that something is going on, if you don't have the will to change it, that you don't have the political agreement that something needs to be done specifically with, say, infrastructure spending or something along those lines, it doesn't do us a whole lot of good other than we just know sooner that something's going on.
We have these three economic witching things that John talked about a few minutes ago that are impending later on this month and later into the fall. We also have this uncertainty about what's going on in Syria and other things that we don't even know about that might hit us in the face down the road politically or in terms of national security. The head of bond investing for Vanguard, which is the world's largest mutual fund company, says that when markets get spooked, as they might with another debt ceiling crisis, investors might flee to quality, and despite the U.S. debt problem, would buy U.S. treasuries. That, in turn, would cause interest rates to fall and bond markets to soar. And although it sounds perverse, is this a good thing or a bad thing, and what should investors do as we approach this witching hour?
Basically, investors should stay put, because one of the things that in that quote that you read, you know, basically the Congress will in fact approve an increase in the debt ceiling, but it'll be at the very last minute. And the more that you as an investor can understand that Congress doesn't work on the same rules that the rest of us do. Congress always waits till the last minute. They always want a lot of attention on what they do, but they will in fact approve the debt ceiling. And yes, last time in August of 2011, when we went through this same thing, it was interesting because everybody talked about, oh my gosh, we might default, the U.S. might default on its debt, it might not make payments. And yet what did people buy? They bought U.S. treasuries, exactly the debt that supposedly we would default on. That's because that's the safest, it's the best thing to buy when you're uncertain. And if that continues, then what it says is, for a normal investor, you want to just sleep through all this. Or what John was saying earlier about your 401k, you just want to pretend it's not going to happen, but the last thing you want to do is make a move trying to do something about it.
I have 10 seconds.
Congress will pass a debt ceiling. Congress will have, at minimum, a continuing resolution. It'll all get done by October 1st. Maybe we will get over the hysteria this third time and not panic.
So the 2014 looks good in North Carolina, according to Dr. John Connaughton of the Babson Capital North Carolina Economic Forecast, a breakout year, and Dr. Kate Warren, investment strategist for Edward Jones. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike.